Today we're bringing you another History 395 podcast. I am Walker Ross, here with Tiffany Parra. How you doing, Tiffany?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm doing pretty well myself, thank you. So, it seems like we learn a lot about the Holocaust and about Adolf Hitler and targeting of Jews, but don't learn too much about what happened to the Jewish children that were living throughout that time. Tiffany actually wrote the paper, Kinder Transport, How Children Were Affected During and After the Long Journey to Safety, to find out more. Tiffany, what really sparked your interest in the Kinder Transport, the children that were affected by Nazism?
I went and had our session with Malia, and before then, I really had an interest in social history. I really wanted to do something on how kids in Britain had moved during Blitzkrieg out of London and into kind of the more rural areas of Great Britain.
Right.
But I was just having so much trouble finding sources and just getting started and really motivating myself to just really get started on it. Then after Malia's research trail, after her showing us all of that, I just really got interested in the Kinder Transport, and I didn't even know it existed. So it felt like while I was researching, I was also learning a lot.
Yeah, I gotta be honest, this is my first time hearing about the Kinder Transport.
Yeah, usually a lot of people don't realize it was ever even a thing, so.
Yeah. So when did this whole thing start up? Like, at what point were Jewish parents like, no more, we need to get our kids out of the country? Were there any events that specifically?
Yeah, so actually happened in around 1938, in November. The Night of Kristallnacht happened in Berlin, which translates to the Night of Broken Glass.
Right.
So what happened there was a lot of Nazis essentially torched synagogues. They broke into Jewish-owned stores. They were pounding on Jewish homes. They were breaking into Jewish homes. They were just perpetrating all of this violence against just Jews. And up to this point, Hitler hadn't yet really instituted any direct violence towards Jews. So this was kind of like the peak of just everything that was going on in Germany. It was the culmination, as you could say, of everything starting to go wrong for the Jews.
Right. Okay, so the actual transport, what was the journey like? It was a railroad, right?
Yeah, so a lot of kids would get transported to a train station by their parents or maybe other family members if their parents were off somewhere. But they would go to these train stations, and there's so many stories of kids, like, gripping the legs of their parents and not wanting to go. Because these are young kids, you know, they've never really experienced being without their parents. The older ones, of course, had to be responsible for the younger ones because they were only allowed one suitcase. And if you were so little, you had to count on your older sibling or maybe an older cousin or something like that to carry your luggage because, you know, you're a baby or something like that. You can't carry it. But, yeah, they were on trains. They'd get on in places like Berlin, other just little, like, counties or towns in Germany, get on the train, and they would make the journey through Germany into Austria. Mm-hmm. They'd drop kids off in France, Ireland. They'd drop them off at in Great Britain, especially, which is what I really wrote my paper on. They were separated from German citizens who maybe weren't Jews.
Okay.
If they picked up someone from France, they were separated from them. And the entire time that they were at least in Germany, they were being watched over by these Nazi guards. So it was really scary. I mean, these kids weren't technically safe until they made it out of Germany.
Right.
These German Nazi guards would steal things from kids. They'd find out that the kid had, like, a piece of jewelry, and they'd steal it from them, or they would steal
Wow.
kids' dolls. And I mean, obviously, they didn't have their parents.
Yeah.
It was scary.
Yeah. Of course.
There's a book by Edith Milton, Tiger in the Attic. She especially kind of hits on her journey in the Kinder Transport and just really talks about how scary it was, even though she did have her sibling.
Mm-hmm.
So you can only imagine how scary it was for the kids who didn't have their sibling or didn't know anybody and were maybe just traveling completely alone.
Right. So, like you said, primarily Great Britain was the target location. Why was Great Britain so prevalent as a good spot for these kids to go to?
Great Britain had the resources.
Okay.
I mean, even they technically didn't have as many resources as one would like. But they had a greater population. They had families who were more wealthy. You had to pay $50 just to collect a kid. If you wanted to be a foster parent, you had to pay to get them. And in 1938, $50 now has the same purchasing power of almost $3,000. So, I mean, think about that, spending $3,000 to pick up a refugee that you don't even know. So Great Britain was just, it was seen as a safe place in the eyes of the people who were sending these children there.
Right. How could they successfully pull this off? Like, you know, the German government wasn't just approving this. I mean, and the Jewish community didn't just do this on their own. Mm-hmm. But in your paper, you talk about there being individuals or groups within the government that were actually advocating for these Jewish kids and helping make a better life for them. What was this group called?
So it was actually three groups within German government. The first Jewish group that was kind of like inside, working inside the German government, was known as the Reich Representation of German Jews. They were kind of like, this group existed before Hitler really started all the violence against Jews, before he made all of his policies that kind of knocked them out of the government. And it was just Jews within the government basically trying to stop something like the Holocaust from happening.
Right.
It was hard for them, I think. But then eventually they dissolved in the later 1930s, and then two other groups kind of came up and replaced them. But they were kind of more hidden away, more secretive, still in the government, but a lot more low-key. They were kind of, instead of being right in the heart of Germany, they were in like satellite counties that maybe Hitler. Right. Still, I don't know how they got away with it. It was really interesting, but when I was researching, I had to kind of stay focused on the kids and not get distracted by all the inner workings of the German government. But, I mean, those groups, they were there before Nazis really took power, and I think they were able to stay there long enough to get 10,000 kids out of Germany and save their lives. And the transportation of children out of Germany by no means was secretive. There were plenty of primary sources that I could find of kids being pulled out of school officially with slips from their parents. Right. That they had received from the German government. Other letters being sent in and out of the chancellor's office telling them that they had been approved to leave. Right. Because what you also have to remember is at this time, the Nazis just wanted Jews out of Germany. They didn't necessarily want to kill them yet.
Right.
They just wanted them gone. They wanted them out of sight, out of mind. This country isn't for you anymore is kind of what I think they believed in at that point. So they saw, like, getting 10,000 kids out of Germany as, like, the best thing ever.
Right.
It was, like, a solution of solutions.
Right. So the goal with the kinder transport is trying to find these kids new families, some foster families, right? But I know you mentioned that a lot of them didn't make it into foster families and ended up in certain camps. You mentioned a Dovercourt camp?
Yeah, so Dovercourt camp, what you have to focus on is these, like, were no means concentration camps.
Right.
They were kind of like giant orphanages that I think they just called them camps, and then later concentration camps came to be, so people kind of get them confused. But Dovercourt camp was kind of like a giant orphanage. They had a lot of dorms, and they had a mess hall. They had an outside area for the kids to play. A lot of kids played dodgeball, played softball, things like that. And it was really the older kids who went there, because a lot of families, just like in America currently, they don't want the older kids that they're going to not really be able to take care of, to that are kind of going to age out soon in a way.
Right.
But yeah, it, just as like it is now, they kind of didn't want those kids, which is really sad. There was actually a couple of reports from the Devercourt camp coming from Women's Services in Great Britain. These kids were apparently really well taken care of. The only real complaint that one woman had was there seemed to be some way of profiting off of catering.
Wow.
Yeah, it was really crazy. I couldn't really tell what she meant because I couldn't, like, find reports from Devercourt. So I don't really know, like, who was profiting off of this catering. But other than that, yeah, like, the kids had heating and air conditioning of the times, of course. They were able to play. They were able to interact.
Right.
A lot of kids sometimes, like, left so they could go work a job because their parents have, like, sent tools with them or sent them tools or things like that. And kids were kind of just trying to make a life for themselves in Great Britain while all this was going on, while they were separated from their parents. And every so often, foster families would also kind of come to Devercourt and other camps and... One girl describes it as they kind of lined them up, and they had the foster families pick what kid they wanted.
Jeez.
It's kind of dehumanizing in a way,
yeah.
But, I mean, you have to look at also the intent. These people thought that they were helping these kids. They didn't see how they were devaluing and dehumanizing them at the same time.
Mm.
It was a lot of indirect discrimination, a lot of indirect... abuses that they didn't realize that they were doing at the time.
Wow. All right, so let's focus on the kids that do actually make it into these foster homes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one can imagine for any kid getting put in a foster family would be tough. But for these kids, they're traveling all that distance, and then there's factors such as religion and language that come into play. You know, obviously they're speaking two different native languages, and then I know in your paper you mentioned that Christianity is the prevalent religion in Great Britain. So how did the differences in religion and language impact the relationship between the foster families and the kids?
Yeah, so that was actually, like, the main point I was making in my paper. A lot of these people who were opening their homes up to kids, Jewish kids, they were Christian. They didn't understand Judaism in the slightest, whether it was Orthodox or non-Orthodox Judaism. Obviously, Jews have specific cultures, traditions, that if you're not Jewish, you don't understand. Like, for example, one child mentioned that he liked walking to synagogue because he was an Orthodox Jew.
Right.
And when he got into a home... he was no longer able to go to synagogue or walk to the church that they made him go to because that just didn't fit in with their schedule. They didn't want to walk. They wanted to drive or take a train or something like that, which it caused at first a lot of friction within families, but a lot of the kids kind of adapted and realized these Christians, these people, they weren't doing it maliciously. They were just kind of continuing on with their lives, and they didn't understand Judaism. They didn't understand the yarmulkes. They didn't understand, not shaving. They didn't understand a kosher diet, of course. There was even stories of kids when they first got into homes going hungry because their families had cooked them omelets with ham, and couldn't eat ham because it's not kosher.
Right.
And because of the language barrier, because of these kids speaking German or, like, Yiddish or things of that nature and not speaking English or whatever other language these families were speaking, they weren't able to communicate that. So they were just kind of pushing food to the side and going to bed hungry. And, yeah, there's a lot of friction within those families at first. It was interesting to analyze. Eventually, those kids who did report having problems at first, they adjusted, and most of them stayed in Great Britain. And even if their parents did survive, their parents moved to Great Britain with them. A lot of them stayed with foster families. At one point, the groups within the German government who put these kids and families were saying that their faith was being compromised because they weren't being placed with Jewish families, so they wanted to remove them. And kids were just screaming and fighting when people would come to collect them. So eventually they just let them stay, and the public back in Germany, the people who were pressing them to remove these kids from these families just kind of had to deal with it and accept that at least these kids were safe.
Yeah. Jeez. You know, it's really tough learning about how hard these kids had it.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you almost got to be grateful that they had a chance at another life outside of Germany.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's what the Jews that were back in Germany kind of realized, is that at least they were safe and had a bed, at the very least, to go home to. And especially once the Holocaust really got started, they didn't have to deal with any of those horrors that were happening in Germany, that they were outside, they were safe there with a family. And that's, I think, at the end, what mattered.
So, altogether, how many kids do you think made it out?
So, there were reports of 10,000 officially making it out through the Kinder transport.
Right.
But a lot of countries had other records of accepting more refugees, but I think those numbers come from adults as well as kids. So I think the Kinder transport numbers and the actual refugee numbers in other countries kind of differ.
Right. Wow. All right. Well, I think that's all the time we have for today. Thank you, Tiffany.
Yeah, of course. Thank you.